which is our face space. And we kept it with the two form, which is closed and non-degenerate. And these properties are meant to exactly encode a non-degenerate Poisson bracket. And the relationship is that is between omega as a two form and pi as a bivector on the same space. So omega is essentially the inverse of pi as a matrix pointwise up to a sign. Now, once we have a Poisson bracket, we can always take a function on phase space and map it onto a vector on phase space. So it's good to give a name to this set of vectors, which we call Hamiltonian vector fields, which by definitions are those x, those vectors, such that there exists a function such that the following equation holds. So this is the contraction of a two form with a vector, which gives us a one form, and the demand is that this one form be exact. So a simple application of Cartan's formula gave us the following proposition, which is the lead derivative of omega along a Hamiltonian vector field is zero. And the interpretation of these is that Hamiltonian vector field preserve our symplectic or Poisson structure. So in a sense, they are symmetries of our phase space structure. Now, a little comment is that the converse is almost true. The only obstructions are global topological obstructions, because what one sees is that d of ix of omega is zero when the converse almost true, that is, if we have that this is zero, then using Cartan's formula again, we can write it like this. And now this is identically zero because the omega is closed. And now we know that this expression must be closed. This must be a closed one form, and a closed one form are locally always exact. One can have just global obstructions. The next important proposition that we saw was the following, that the Lie brackets of two Hamiltonian vector fields, so this is a Lie bracket between vector fields in on P, is actually itself a Hamiltonian vector field for which function? For the function given by the Poisson bracket of the two functions. Finally, we gave a definition of a Lie algebra action on our phase space, which is the following. We take a Lie algebra and then we take a function that takes an element of our Lie algebra and sends it into vector fields. And this, we want it to be linear. I didn't say it explicitly, it was implicit in the following property, but it's good to emphasize it. And we want this row to be a homomorphism of Lie algebras. So being a homomorphism of Lie algebra means that I have a Lie algebra structure here, I have it there, and I want row to preserve it. So this means that the bracket, so the row of a bracket is a bracket of the two rows. Now, these two brackets is important to remember that they're different. This is a bracket in the Lie algebra, and this is a bracket among the vector spaces, the vector fields. Finally, I concluded from this and Frobenius theorem the fact that there exist submanifolds of P, which are called orbits. I said it in a very complicated way. Since the concept is actually much simpler, let me rephrase it by cheating a bit. Let's say that G, I didn't want to introduce a group action, but it's easier in this case. So let's say that G is the, there is a group action. So we have a group that acts on P, and rho is just the infinitesimal version. So once you have a group action, there always exists a row, which you've built many, many times by taking the infinitesimal version of whatever that action is. And now the point is that every z in P is sent to an orbit z, which is the set of elements of P in which z is taken by the action, and this is a submanifold. If things are good enough, nice enough, these are submanifolds, and these are exactly the object I introduced yesterday, last time, in a more complicated way. So I wanted just to say that there is a much simpler way to think about these orbits. Okay, any questions before I move on? Just to make an example, a type of action could be, let's say, in this picture, translations upwards. So this is z, and these are its orbits, like this. But a different type of action could be rotations. So for example, I still have my plane, but now I get different points are sent. And these are the orbits. So these are my OZ. Should have written here. OZ, and this is OZ is a circle. And you see that these actions do not have fixed points. So points are all move under the action of my group. So this is a picture for what is a free action, free of fixed points. Whereas this one is a bit different because there is like an origin which is sent to itself, and so this is a non-free action, for sure. And clearly, there is an important difference, which is the orbit spaces look very different. So here, the orbit space, if you quotient these, you just get a line underneath. Every orbit is sent to a point on this line. Whereas here, you get a half line, right? So there is a distinct point in the space of orbits, which is the origin. So just to say that there are different types of actions.
Oh, what happened here? Nope.
Okay, this is not going to go well. The screen is all scrambled up and I don't know what I'm doing. And okay, this is normal at least. Okay. So any questions so far? Yes. Yes, Chris.
It's like the extension, like you're kind of we're cheating a bit with this definition compared to the previous one, meaning like that infinitesimal action is not always like globally integrable into some form
of
action.
No, that's the point of that Frobenius theorem I quoted before, that the action is always integrable, right. Which means that those orbits as manifolds exist. I don't need to speak about the group action. It just makes the statement more complicated.
Yeah, okay.
But the submanifold OZ exists even if, like, I didn't need to introduce the group action to talk about that.
Yeah, okay.
Good. Okay, so next, the next big, today we want to close that diagram that we drew last time, so let me draw it again, and we will fill it in slowly. So we want, like let's say the theorem we want to go after, which is like a summary of all these concepts, is the following. We have function on field space, which are mapped into Hamiltonian vector fields, which is a subset of vector fields on phase space. And here the map is this x dot. So is what I wrote up there. If we have a function, we can always map it onto a Hamiltonian vector field. So I should have mentioned that equation, Ix omega equal minus df, is the same as this one, of course, just with the, instead of the Poisson bracket, I have put the omega on the other side, since the omega is essentially an inverse Poisson bracket. Now, not all vector fields are Hamiltonian, so this is just an injection, which is what this hook stands for. It's like a subset kind of thing. So what you get in this space, but you don't get all of it. You just get some of it. Then we also introduce a Lie algebra with its own Poisson bracket, Lie bracket. And we also said that by definition of what we mean by action is that there is a homomorphism between this Lie algebra and that Lie algebra. And again, we get an injection like this, which is given by our action. Now, it would be nice to close this diagram. And this is what we're going to do now. We're going to fill in this blank. So what do we need? We have functions that go into Hamiltonian vector fields. We have an action that takes a Lie algebra element to a vector field. The only thing that we need to do is to put these two concepts together and ask that the action is Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian action, which I can also call kinematical symmetry. It's kinematical because I've not been speaking about dynamics. I'm only talking about phase-space structure. So in that sense, I'm speaking about kinematics. So the concept here is that we want an action rho, which is Hamiltonian. What does this mean? It means that these vector fields are all Hamiltonian. That is, we want a function j that takes a Lie algebra element and sends it to a function, a map that takes a Lie algebra element and sends it to a function, such that for all xi, I rho xi omega is equal to this. So this map has a name. It's called a comomentum map. Now, when you see a co, it means that there is also the version without the co. And so we'll go to see in a second to see what that is. Is this definition clear? Why that formula is just a summary of this statement? OK. So let's see what the momentum map is. So the point here is that this function must be linear because the left-hand side is linear. What does it mean, linear? It means that j of a xi plus b eta is equal to a j xi plus b j eta when a and b are in R and xi eta are in the Lie algebra. Remember, we had the Lie algebra is a real vector space, so this is why this makes sense. Because the left-hand side of this equation, left-hand side of is linear x in C, which comes from the definition of what we meant by this, what is there? This Lie algebra homomorphism, by definition, was a linear map, which means that we can dualize this map it means that there is a map J that instead of going from G to functions, it takes element of P. We dualize this mapping and we go into the dual of the Lie algebra. So in this case, linearity is just made explicit into baked in into my definition. So that's why this is a bit nicer, such that j xi at z, so remember this is a function, so we evaluate it at a point, is equal to jz at xi. Evaluated on xi, and so this is what we call the momentum map. This looks all very abstract, but in fact, you have been trading in momentum maps since very early on in your physics career. So let me convince you that that's the case. Not good. I don't know what I'm doing. Absolutely no idea. This is horrendous. What happens if I do this? I don't know how to stop these things. Front, rear, fixed. This, I don't know what. Oh, finally, okay. Okay, good. Nope. Sorry. Okay. Rear. Now I'm back to the usual screen thing, so I know how to deal with it. Okay, so let me convince you that this momentum map, you have seen it many, many times. So let's go back to the basics. So we have translations. So configuration space for n particles is R3 to the n, right? This is an n particle configuration space. And then phase space is T star of Q. So this is R6 to the n. And points here, we call them P's and Q for each particle alpha. No? So far, so good. So if you remember, we calculated last time, we saw that translations were, sorry, let me write this first. Phase space is the combination of phase space for each single particle. Now, is the product, so the symplectic structure is the sum. We saw last time that translations, in this case, act as, sorry, let me write it correctly. So this is the sum. So how does the translation act? Acts equally on each particle and just moves the Qs around, doesn't touch the Ps. So this is our translation action. And now we computed it last time just for one particle, but of course nothing changes. We computed that, we computed these and found that it is Hamiltonian. So how do we see it? We just contract these with that, we get zero. We contract this with this, we get xi. So this is, and the, since xi, well, let me do it in two steps. So this becomes minus dp alpha dot xi. Minus because we go across this dp when we contract to hit on that one. And so this is nothing else than d sum from alpha to of xi, doesn't matter. So you see this is a linear function in psi. It's a function on phase space, which is linear in psi. So from here, this is our j of xi. But of course, it's immediate to see that the momentum map in question is, I should have added a little information here. So g in this case is R3 with this, well, it's a translation, so it's kind of obvious. So j was this, is this map like that, and we end up in R3. And what is this map? We know that j of q alpha, p alpha, is nothing else than the sum over all alpha of p alpha. And we see that is valued in R3. I'm just reading it off from here. Because it's linear, I can just pull it out. And then, by definition, this will be j xi, where this is just a pairing. So when I pair it, it's like putting the xi out of the sum. So maybe a slightly less trivial example is rotations. If this is clear, is it clear? Rotations also. So in this case, I keep the same. Everything is the same. But now what I'm looking at is the algebra of SO3, which again is R3. So I expect my j to be valued in R3. We already did the computation last time, so I'm not going to repeat the details, but you can imagine what this J is in this case. Will be the sum of the individual angular momenta, and is also valued in R3. What is this?
No, the G star.
Oh, sorry. G star is just the dual vector space. So the dual vector space of R3 is just R3. Yeah, yeah. So is the dual just as a vector space?
Your definition of the momentum map, this has nothing to do with the inner product on any space, right? It's just a natural pairing.
Like. Yes. In R3, if we wanted to be extremely careful, we would put, So let's take this case. Just let's work it out a bit more. We say that this is R3 with the basis EI. So what does it mean? It means that an element of R3 can be written like this. Now, what is G star? G star is the dual, is also isomorphic to R3, but now we have a dual basis, which I call F. It's not the best name, but let me call it F. But now I want the index up. Why do I want the index up? Because I'm always pairing an element of the dual with an element of the vector space, and the dual basis is the one for which this holds. And now an element in the dual, for example, J, let's say that J is an element of the dual vector space, can always be written as Ji Fi. And then J Xi will be Ji Xi I. Now, here all of this is implicit, but in principle, this J has a lower index because it's the one that is paired with the vector. So I'm not really using the metric on R3 in this story. Thanks for the question, because it allowed to clarify this. Everything is really abstracted from that context. I have never introduced the metric because this omega does not need to introduce a metric at all. Even if Q is curved, this would hold as long as there is a good notion of translations on it. But that's.
Sorry, this may be basic, but I'm just trying to run through the computation of the condition on J tilde and J. And so if we were to evaluate this J eta on some Z space, what would that look like? Like, how would you, because currently it's just written in the basis.
So here, for example, so J tilde, let me write it maybe here. So in this case, translations, J Xi is a map, is a function on field space, on phase space, sorry, which once evaluated on a point. So what is a point on phase space here? A point on phase space, is a set of P's and Q's. A choice of P's and Q's. So once I evaluate this function on phase space, this is the same as evaluating it at some a certain fixed P's and Q's. And this is what I've written here. This is psi I, so psi I sum over alpha of P alpha I. So here I've been careful with the index structure, just to make it a bit clearer. Let me be careful with the index structure on this other side as well. So for rotations, what we have is that j tilde psi at z is equal, well, again, it's like evaluating these as certain fixed P's and Q's. And this is psi I. Now, what am I really using here is the, well, there are, OK, let me try to be consistent with the indices. So I want an epsilon like this. Then I want, well, there is a big sum. Well, I can put the epsilon outside, so there is a sum. P alpha Q alpha. So this index will have to be high, this index is low, and this should be like this. It looks a bit weird. The reason is that to write these things, the reason why you have, well, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, if I want to be careful with indices, the object that they need to construct is this one. There is this epsilon. Yeah.
Do you have an example of action that does not include
usually there, if you have in mind the natural action with the physical interpretation, usually it will be a symmetry. But like, if I, do you remember we considered a variation of these where there is a magnetic field? Do you remember that? And so in that case, I could add something like Bij of Q, dQ I alpha dQ J alpha. These would be the same particle now moving in a, well, I didn't put the dynamics, but this would be, this is still a viable symplectic structure as long as this is a magnetic field, so its curl is zero. So now, in this case, translations would not be Hamiltonian because it depends, it will if be in general, right? Because I contract these like this, but I get this, and then I get plus b dq xi, but this is not clearly, I cannot pull out the d in general. So what happens is that the magnetic field is breaking translation symmetry, if you want. That's a possibility.
You mentioned in the notes that the momentum maps are defined up to a G star valued constant.
Thanks. I'll get there in a moment. Yes.
G is a map from the phase space to G star. In both these examples, G is similar as the configuration space. So if we had some non-trivial G like SUN or something, because J in this example is just summation over all P alpha.
Mm-hmm.
But the configuration space is same as the Lie algebra. But if we had a non-trivial example, I don't see how this would work.
It might not be. Do I have a? You have. If you have a non. So here everything is easy because the reason why everything is easy here is because I have global coordinates on P. Now, in general, you have to work, if you have a non-trivial phase space, then you would have to work with patches and so on. So last time we saw a non-trivial example of a phase space, which is not of that form. And this was P, take P to be the two sphere, and omega, and let's use, we can use polar coordinates on this. Spherical coordinates on this sphere. And with these, we can define omega to be, omega abstractly is defined as the area form. On the round sphere, and locally, this is equal to, in a chart, to d cos theta wedge d phi up to a constant, but that's not important. Now you can have a group acting on this, which is, let's say, of course you can generalize this to arbitrary rotations. It just gets more complicated, but the easy one to do would be rotations, so SO2, it's real, SO2 as rotations around the z-axis, which, what do they do? They rotate phi, right? So these are, so you see here, it looks, if you do it, it just looks like this other example. But in fact, in reality, you're working on a closed manifold in coordinates. So this patch does not cover everything. The poles don't really work well in this. But in the end, when you write down things in coordinates, you always go back to a situation like that. Why? Because by Darboux theorem, any phase space can be written in this form locally. Of course, which P's and Q's you're choosing must be adapted to the type of problem you're working with. So you can try to adapt it to your symmetries. And if everything goes well, you are quite often in a situation like this, essentially. You could try to work out what happens with SO3. Of course, it's much more complicated because rotation in the other direction don't write as nicely. But you can do it. You can have an arbitrary rotation of the sphere and try to write it. I will not try here because it would be a disaster. Yeah? Good. So one remark is what Vincent was hinting towards, which is I can always redefine J by a constant. Why? Because it's inside a D. So if J is a momentum map, then so remember, momentum map is a map from P to G star, and lambda is an element of G star, which does not depend on P. It's just an element, but still, I can translate my momentum map by a constant. And the reason, proof of this simple remark is just that G of J plus lambda is equal to the G of G. It's just that, because these depend on Z, so we can put it, maybe I should write it like this, so it's a bit clearer. right? It's just extremely simple. But this will influence what's coming next. So here, I could always say that my translations are P plus whatever vector. I will not notice it because it will just drop from the Poisson bracket and everything. So as a generator, it doesn't really matter. This is true also here. But in general, there is a preferred choice. And the reason why there is a preferred choice, especially in the non-abelian case, is because this lambda will affect the equivariance properties of J. So let's see what these are. Basically, the idea here is that J is not just an element, a function with three indices. This is a vector itself. It means that under rotations itself, it transforms itself as a vector. So we want to encode this in this more abstract formulation where the momentum map itself transforms under the symmetry appropriately. Yes?
I think maybe I'm just misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. What does it mean that lambda doesn't depend on phase space?
It's just a fixed. No. Lambda is just a fixed element of the dual of the Lie algebra. So if in one of these examples would be like adding to this a constant vector that does not depend on P and Q. This would do the same job as J as far as that equation, the star equation is concerned, right? Because it's inside the D. It just doesn't see it. I will now argue, however, that there is a way to actually fix this constant. Because what would happen if I act with rotations on the P's and Q's? This guy would rotate. This would stay fixed. So J would not transform nicely. So this is what I want to get to. So in a sense, I can do it. But often, there is a good way to fix it. So this is the concept of equivariance, which is what physicists call covariance. It's just one of these language things. It just means, so here the idea is that J transforms covariantly under rotations. And so mathematicians talk about equivariance. So what do we want to do? Let me define an object and then discuss its properties and see in which way it relates to what we're discussing. Let me just introduce this thing here, which is L rho psi g. Actually, no. Let's do it the other way around. This is a bit too abstract. Let me start from the Hamiltonian flow equation, which is the star equation here, which is the crucial equation, the central equation of all this business. And let me take the lead derivative of this equation along a symmetry. What does this mean? Taking the lead derivative along a symmetry of that equation means applying a symmetry. So let me infinitesimally rotate that equation. So I want to take L rho xi of the equation star. Well, maybe eta because xi is already taken. Okay? And this will be 0. So how do I compute this? I take everything let me start from the right-hand side. On the right-hand side, I have, maybe I don't have enough room here, so go over here. I get minus rho eta d j xi. D crosses L, goes across without any extra factors. And so I get, I get this right hand side. So here we see that this is, this can also be written as minus d of L rho eta of j psi. Remember, the difference between j tilde and j is just that I make explicit the linearity of j in psi. So psi is a constant from the phase space perspective. So this lead derivative doesn't do anything to psi. So I can just pull it out. That's just what this is. It's just saying that this derivative acts on the field space, on the phase space dependent, which is just inside this j, not on the psi. So I've isolated how my angular momentum, let's say, transforms under rotations. That's why I'm doing this. What's on the other side of the equation? I have the lead derivative of this. Now, using Cartan's calculus, essentially the lead derivative nicely distributes across the two terms. So there is a first term, which is the lead derivative of rho xi along rho eta, which is just the lead bracket of the two vectors. And then I have a term, which is the lead derivative of omega, but we know that this is zero because of one of the initial lemmas that we discussed. Yes?
When we take the lead derivative of j tilde, we are taking the lead derivative of a C infinity function.
Mm-hmm.
But when we take the lead derivative of j, this lead derivative is on the Lie algebra.
No. So exactly. Maybe I should have written it another way to write this, to think of this, maybe. Is as a function, is if j is smooth, j tilde is smooth, also j will be smooth. Is a smooth function valued not in R, is not a real valued function, is valued in some vector space, which is G star. So in both cases, I'm deriving the dependence on P, except that here it's just a different way of thinking about the same object. In this case, I think of it as saying, to each psi, I assign one function. Whereas here, I think, forget about psi. The dependence on psi is trivial. I just have a function valued in the dual, and then I'm free to plug in whichever psi I like. It's just a different perspective, but is the same function I'm really deriving. Here, it would be deriving, I think it's kind of clear if you look at, at here, the xi is completely passive. There is something inside. All the derivative acts on the p's and the q's, or if you plug xi in here or not, it doesn't really matter. OK, so what is this? By definition of the action, we know that this is the rho of the bracket. So this is I rho of the bracket. But now we know that also this is given by, because now this is in the same form as equation as my star equation, I get that this is minus d j tilde of the bracket. Or equivalently, I can say that this is minus j the bracket. Or equivalently, you probably don't see it as well, I will summarize it in a second. A different way to think about this is I have eta acting on xi because I want to isolate xi, right? So, you know, here you have an adjoint action. I can dualize it to get a coadjoint action. So this is by definition of what coadjoint means. It means that I can take I can take it to is what is like a transpose in it's like taking if you think of these as matrices as a matrix operation of eta on psi, if you take the transpose you're taking the action on this side to the left hand side is just a way of repackaging things. Oops. Okay, so now we can compare. And if we do, what do we find? We find that we have a big D, which is the D appearing here and there and there. So let me write it in two ways, one for J tilde and one for straight J. So, but the two equations are the same. You pick the one you like better. So in one case, we have L rho eta J tilde. Well, there's a minus, but I'm taking it. Oh, OK. So in this case, there is a minus. And here I have equals 0. And in the other case, I get this is really just the same. I just remove the xi from this equation. It's just a more compact way to write the same equation. There is a sign because of, the sign is not very important. It's part of the definition of what this adjoint, coadjoint action is. So here we see that we're almost done. Well, we are done to the extent that if we look at what this is for rotations, for example, we have that we're asking how does angular momentum transform under an infinitesimal rotation? And here we get the answer. Basically. Well, there is a D, which I will get to in a second. But let's forget about the D for a moment. And the answer is it transforms. So this is acting on Z. So this is, on this side of the expression, we have whether it's downstairs or upstairs doesn't matter, is an action on P, because this is a Lie derivative on phase space, whereas on this side, it's an action on G star. Everything here is happening inside the Lie algebra. G or G star, it's dualized, so whichever one or G star. So this is telling, since I have an object that is defined on a space but is valued in another, I can say that if I transform the space on which is defined, is the same as transforming the target space, maybe. So this is the best case scenario. And that's up to this D, this is what this equation is telling me. So this is telling me, if I plug in rotations, and I encourage you to do it, tells me that angular momentum transforms covariantly, transforms as a vector. So this is an epsilon. This bracket is an epsilon. So it's telling me the angular momentum itself transforms with an epsilon under rotations. So here we get our definition. Definition. I can't move this afterwards. The definition is that if this equality holds without the D, then we say that J is equivariant. J is a momentum map for action rho. Well, it's a momentum map. Is equivariant if and only if L rho eta of J is equal to minus R eta star J. If you want to use J tilde, you just replace it with equations above. So for rotations, example, let's write it. Example rotations. We know that L rho of eta of J is equal to as a vector, right? This is equal to eta cross J up to a sign which I haven't checked. But this is what this is telling me. This add star is just an epsilon because it comes from the Lie bracket, which for SO3 is just an epsilon. So this is that product. So we see that this is a transformation on the P's and Q's, and this is instead a transformation in the internal indices. Well, in the algebra indices. Okay, now remark. So you can check that if J is equivariant, J plus lambda is not. So there is a way to fix this lambda sometimes by if you require J to be equivariant or fixing lambda, it's not always possible, but it often is. In most examples, in all examples we will look at, it is possible. If you look at the notes, I explain what the correct generalization is when therefore equivariance So an equivariant moment map is not ambiguous under, like, the ambiguity that was present there is removed by asking equivariance. I don't want to write it. It would be too many words. Is it always possible to ask J to be equivariant? No, but usually it is. It's interesting to ask when it's not, but it would take us along a different path, so I will not do it. Let me just summarize what we did by going back to our big theorem because we just completed it. So we have a phase space with a Poisson bracket, and we know that we can take a function to a vector field. And this gives us Hamiltonian vector fields inside all possible vector fields on phase space. And in particular, if we have a Lie algebra action, we can map a Lie algebra onto an algebra of vector fields on phase space. And now we also say that if we have a momentum map, I'll prove it in a line in a second. So we want to prove this last arrow, and this arrow is possible when we have J an equivariant momentum map. So well, how does this work? We want to show that this bracket is sent into that bracket, but we basically have already done it because we know that equivariance proof, the last we just have to prove this one here. We have a, so by equivariance we know that J tilde xi is equal to J tilde eta xi. This is equivariance, so it's part of our hypothesis. But what is the left-hand side? We know that this is a Hamiltonian vector field. So deriving a Lange Hamiltonian vector field, is like taking the Poisson bracket. So here we use, since rho eta is nothing else than the Hamiltonian vector field for J tilde eta, right, is the other two arrows, essentially, then L rho eta is equal of J tilde xi is equal to the bracket between J, well, let me do it in two step. This is this, and this is also this. So by combining this and that, we see that J of eta psi is nothing else than the bracket between the two J's. So what does this mean? It means that the Poisson algebra of the generators is a representation of the algebra we started with. So the bracket between two angular momenta is epsilon times the angular momentum. So this you've seen in all possible ways when you're doing QFT. You always have some commutator which you want to represent the algebra you're trying to implement. So these are the charges, and this is the charge algebra if you want. You've done it for sure in QFT when you try to implement Lorentz or Poincaré symmetry. No? You're building particles out of that and so on. You start from this equation. You don't even question it. But this is where it's truly coming from.